This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with background and analysis from the correspondents who cover the news. And now from Washington, here's CBS News national correspondent Dan Rabin.
With a special edition of the Weekend Roundup, Revolution in Egypt. It happened on Friday, a 30-second announcement on state-run television in Cairo, heard through an interpreter on Al Jazeera English. We heard Vice President Omar Suleiman talking about his boss, his close colleague, President Hosni Mubarak.
My fellow citizens, at these hard circumstances our country is experiencing, President Mohammed Hosni Mubarak has decided to waive the office of the President of the Republic and instructed the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces to run the affairs of the country.
And with that, Hosni Mubarak's reign over Egypt was over. Hundreds of thousands of people who'd gathered to protest yet again started cheering, and they did not stop. CBS News correspondent Vicky Barker on the scene.
30 years of military dictatorship brought down by 18 days of people power. The political scientists will spend the next few decades trying to figure this one out. The people here are simply celebrating their achievement. Some protesters have climbed up onto the giant lion statues guarding the Nile River Bridge, and they are waving flags and chanting and whistling. Welcome to the world's biggest birthday party.
There were even fireworks above Tahrir, or Liberation Square, Friday night.
The makeshift barricades guarding Liberation Square have been dismantled, and the razor wires been pushed to one side. A human tide of people flowing into Liberation Square to celebrate this extraordinary moment in Egyptian history.
And correspondent Vicky Barker kept sending audio postcards.
A conga line of veiled women in long robes has just snaked by, and I've just seen a doctor still in his surgical robes waving an Egyptian flag. Welcome to the biggest birthday party on the planet. These people celebrating what they see as the birth of a new Egypt.
Thursday, there'd been the crush of disappointment. All day, reports indicated Hosni Mubarak would resign. But when he gave his speech, he did not quit, insisting for the sake of the Egyptian people, he would preside over a transition. The protesters said it was a trick, and they vowed the biggest ever protest would occur Friday, and it looks like it did. CBS News correspondent Harry Smith was there.
We're reporting from Tahrir Square in downtown Cairo, where a multitude of people, tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds and hundreds of thousands, have converged on this square, where for 2.5 weeks, peaceful protests have gone on for the idea that the will of the people would in fact stand, that their steadfastness would in fact prevail over the thuggery and thievery of Mubarak and his regime. Thousands and thousands and thousands of people. And the chanting goes on and on of a celebration of a state of almost ecstasy. Now they've achieved their goal. And the feeling here is almost disbelief. A man I was talking to who spoke some English came over and kissed me and he said, thank you, thank you, thank you. Euphoria, peace, and a new sense of hope for one of the oldest civilizations on Earth.
CBS's Harry Smith in downtown Cairo. At the White House Friday afternoon, President Obama welcomed what he called history being made by the people of Egypt.
By stepping down, President Mubarak responded to the Egyptian people's hunger for change. But this is not the end of Egypt's transition. It's a beginning. I'm sure there will be difficult days ahead, and many questions remain unanswered. There's something in the soul that cries out for freedom. Those were the cries that came from Tahrir Square, and the entire world has taken note. Today belongs to the people of Egypt, and the American people are moved by these scenes in Cairo and across Egypt because of who we are as a people and the kind of world that we want our children to grow up in. The word Tahrir means liberation. It is a word that speaks to that something in our souls that cries out for freedom. And forevermore, it will remind us of the Egyptian people, of what they did, of the things that they stood for, and how they changed their country, and in doing so, changed the world.
There are some tough questions, maybe dangerous unknowns for the United States. Egypt has been a very cooperative Arab country, a recipient of $70 billion in U.S. aid over the past 30 years. The key question, has America lost an ally? With a look back at Hosni Mubarak's career, yes, he's 82 years old, but we don't think he intended to retire. Here's CBS News correspondent Mark Phillips.
Hosni Mubarak himself had come to power in an act of rebellion on the streets. He was the loyal vice president when Anwar Sadat was assassinated by fundamentalist members of his own armed forces during a military parade in 1981. Sadat died for making peace with the old enemy, Israel, and for cozying up to the West. Mubarak, an ex-Air Force commander, was a political unknown, but he too chose peace. But if Mubarak was Western-looking in his foreign policy and received billions in U.S. aid money in return, he was an old-time authoritarian at home. He faced challenges from those opposed to the peace with Israel and from the increasingly influential Muslim Brotherhood. And he used the state security apparatus to maintain his power.
We honor a man who has emerged as a source of quiet strength at a time when such traits are sorely needed.
Hosni Mubarak's support for Western policies over his almost three decades in power made him a reliable partner for a succession of American presidents. And when Iraq invaded Kuwait in 1990, his support for the American-led counter-invasion was critical. But relations were not always easy. Egypt did not support the George W. Bush post-9/11 invasion of Iraq.
He should understand. It's a very sensitive and dangerous situation.
Mubarak's Egypt was a frequent terrorist target. They killed tourists, and they tried to kill him in 1995 as he arrived at an African summit.
For me, it was shocking. What's that? Then I realized that there are bullets coming to our car.
It was no accident that President Obama chose Cairo early in his presidency to make an appeal for better relations between the U.S. and the Arab world.
I've come here to Cairo to seek a new beginning between the United States and Muslims around the world.
Whatever else he was, Hosni Mubarak was a pillar of stability in the Middle East and a focal point of American foreign policy. Egypt, in fact the entire region, is a different, less predictable, and more dangerous place without him.
CBS News correspondent Mark Phillips, and we've just begun this special edition of the CBS News Weekend Roundup, Revolution in Egypt.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Ravine.
On this special edition focused on the revolution in Egypt, many of the protesters called themselves the January 25th movement. That was the date almost 3 weeks ago when demonstrations began in Tahrir Square, not far from the world-famous Egyptian Museum, the state-run TV headquarters, and official government-controlled newspapers. Someone set fire to the large headquarters of the NDP, President Mubarak's political party. The building quickly was gutted, unusable. Throughout this crisis, a charred symbol of a dictatorship on its way out. On Monday, January 31st, CBS News correspondent Elizabeth Palmer reported from Cairo.
Tell anyone who orders you to fire on us, no, the demonstrators chanted. We are your people. People who have found a voice and a place to call their own. Liberation Square has become, as one demonstrator called it, the moral heart of Egypt.
He will be here until he gets out.
The atmosphere is a mixture of jamboree, mass picnic, and religious festival. Everyone, right down to the very youngest, understands the goal. Leave, Mubarak.
The next day, Tuesday, February 1st, CBS's Mark Strassman's report.
They're hoping to rewrite Egyptian history. By and large, the faces of this revolt are political and religious moderates, not professional protesters, but in many cases, educated, secular, first-time activists. fed up, but fired up too.
On Tuesday night, February 1st, President Mubarak appeared on official TV, his second speech to the nation during the crisis. He said he's been making changes. He appealed to the demonstrators, said he'd been listening to them, and announced he won't run for re-election, and his son Gamal quit his party posts and would not run for president. His government said the protesters should immediately go home. And Wednesday, somebody tried to enforce that. Men who shouted slogans in support of Hosni Mubarak arrived wielding fists and sticks. Several on horseback or riding camels used whips to hit protesters in Tahrir Square. Later, there were stones, gunfire, and gasoline bombs, those flaming bottles called Molotov cocktails. Katie Couric reported it was like civil war had broken out in Tahrir Square.
By nightfall, it had only escalated. Molotov cocktails replaced the sticks and stones of the afternoon clashes. A message on Twitter spoke volumes. Oh my God, we are in Tahrir Square. They are killing us. The thugs have killed us.
CBS News correspondent Vicky Barker brought us vivid radio reports from the freedom-seeking streets.
Marching to Tahrir Square, Mohammed, an engineer.
The Egyptian people is a great people. We deserve better from this state.
Noha, a housewife.
We are educated, we know our rights, and we have to choose.
Police states aren't big on opinion polls, so it's hard to say just how representative of Egypt's 89 million people protesters like Noha and Mohammed really are. But they're enough to have the government running scared after 30 years of iron control.
And Friday, February 4th, Vicky Barker on trouble after Muslim Friday prayers.
The day began with cheers from the anti-government protesters as an army tank chased pro-government forces off a bridge overlooking Tahrir Square. But as the sun set, more gunfire and more rampaging. This time it was protesters streaming out of the square and mounting a counterattack on President Mubarak's loyalists. The demonstrators' commitment to nonviolent change through peaceful protest appears to be wavering.
This past Wednesday, February 9th, protesters moved to other parts of the capital.
I'm Vicky Barker outside the Parliament building in Cairo. It is Liberation Square, Part 2. Hundreds of protesters are blocking the entrance to Egypt's Parliament. They are allowing staffers to leave. They are not letting anyone back in. The army is out in force, but it is not using force. And in between chanting Mubarak out, the protesters are chanting, "The people and the army are one."
And Vicky Barker took us into the square, ground zero for a democracy movement.
First, you wait online, a long line that stretches across the Nile River Bridge. Passing cars honk, sometimes in support, sometimes in annoyance that you're blocking traffic. You're sharing this line with a veritable human smorgasbord. Old men reading newspapers, families with babies in strollers, women in headscarves and long robes, men with the long hair and beards of the devout Muslim, westernized kids, guys in jeans and girls who've clearly spent hours making sure their hair and makeup look effortlessly gorgeous. Oh, and all of these different demographics periodically holding up their camera phones to take pictures of the crowds. Whoever said the revolution will not be televised never envisioned YouTube. So you shuffle along till you reach the outer perimeter of Liberation Square, marked by razor wire and tanks and sandbags and the soldiers courteously asking for your identification. I don't record that because who wants to get arrested for illegally recording something tedious? Then you snake through the protesters' makeshift barricades. In this case, a lot of corrugated aluminum sheeting and a burned-out car that's been pushed on its side. The women are briefly frisked by courteous young women protesters, some completely veiled. And then you're through, to be greeted by parallel lines of cheering protesters, smiling and welcoming you with wedding chants, interspersed with "Down with Hosni Mubarak" chants. Don't look for a center in this melee. There isn't one. Think of a tropical reef with different schools of fish floating around, sometimes intermingling, sometimes darting off any which way. This sounds like fiery political rhetoric. It's certainly attracted a big and rapt crowd. In fact, it is a woman reading from the works of a famous Egyptian poet. And these are people singing the national anthem, accompanied by traditional folk instruments. Over there, perched on a highway divider, are a bunch of students and young professionals and one burly young guy who has Muslim Brotherhood written all over him. They are unimpressed with the government's epic catalog of concessions.
That's what we call a political striptease, giving piece by piece, bit by bit, and just postponing the change that we really need.
A young woman with them says this is only her second time here. She came the first time to see for herself if all the terrible things the Egyptian media have been saying about the protests were true.
I came in, I was afraid because I thought it was going to be very dangerous, and I just got out feeling like this was the safest place on earth.
But if they come and take you to jail, if they come and take you to
prison, if they take us to jail? 85 million?
And even if they took our lives, we are here to win. According to Gandhi in the revolution of India, he said that first they will ignore you, then they will try to kill you, and then they will negotiate, and finally we will win. And we will win and we will leave, inshallah.
A conservative Muslim quoting Mahatma Gandhi on nonviolent resistance, capping it all off with, inshallah, if God wills it. Welcome to Liberation Square.
That's CBS News correspondent Vicky Barker in Cairo, and I'm Dan Raviv with this special edition of the CBS News Weekend Roundup, Revolution in Egypt. On this special edition of the CBS News Weekend Roundup, Revolution in Egypt, I'm Dan Raviv. That's the sound of Friday prayers in Cairo, not in a mosque, but outdoors in Tahrir or Liberation Square. A short while later, minutes after 6 p.m. Cairo time Friday, the Vice President Omar Suleiman, who got that job just 2 weeks ago, announced that his boss, Hosni Mubarak, had stepped down from the presidency. Surrender by former Air Force chief, self-described war hero, Mubarak. The people in the square, who hate him as a dictator, cheered. So Egyptian protesters were celebrating in Cairo, but let's turn to Aaron David Miller, longtime Middle East mediator for the U.S. government, now at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. Should the American people be celebrating this news?
I think absolutely. No one can look at these pictures. No one could look at the events over the past 2 weeks and not be inspired by the extraordinary commitment, courage, the essential secular nature, moderate centrist nature of what has transpired in Cairo. And what's so remarkable is that this event sends two unmistakable signals. It sends an unmistakable signal and a message to Al-Qaeda and its acolytes that change can come, not just from militant Islam and violence and extremism, but from organized, largely peaceful protests. And it also sends an unmistakable message to the authoritarians, some of which America allies with and some of which we don't in the region, that you better start looking in your rearview mirror and try to figure out how to adjust, because you may be hearing footprints and footsteps soon. So I don't think there's any doubt that this is a moment that needs to be appreciated and really enjoyed. At the same time, there's an asterisk here, because the process of democratization in a country like Egypt will be long and slow, and it's going to produce a political system, a style of governance, that by definition will almost certainly become more critical of American policies. You're going to have Islamic currents, secular nationalist currents reflected in parliament. You're going to have a much freer press. You're going to have a real opposition, not some frozen sclerotic system that had existed for the last 30 years. And by definition, these opponents, the new political reformers, will be critical of American policy. They're going to be critical of our containment of Iran strategy. They'll most likely be critical of our views of Gaza and Hamas. They may be reluctant to participate as closely as the Mubarak regime participated in our counterterrorism campaign. And I don't think they're going to be acquiescent, that is to say, the new whoever rules in Egypt, to our peace process strategies. There'll be more criticism of Israel and more support for Palestinian struggle. So I wouldn't argue this is mixed. This is an extraordinary development, historic, that needs to be appreciated on its own merits. But it will narrow the space within which American policy and certainly the Israelis have operated in Egypt.
Aaron, you were, in a sense, predicting what the eventual Egyptian government will be like. But in the short term, the military is running the show, and the Egyptian military is very close to the United States.
Yeah, and I think we need to understand one basic reality. Egypt has been and is now still a Praetorian state, where the military dominates not just the national security policies, but the politics of Egypt as well as its economy. I mean, the Minister of Defense, Tantawi, is also the head of military production. The military owns farms, it owns collectives, it owns businesses, it owns industries. It doesn't pay taxes. It has tremendous privilege. And the real issue, it seems to me, is can that power be reconciled with the aspirations of those Egyptians on the streets in a very broad-based reformist movement who want probably a separation of civil and military authority? No doubt a system that's more accountable, more transparent, without corruption, and without that kind of privilege.
So if the military were to try to stop the democracy process, what would happen? The people would pour into the streets again?
I think if we're talking about an arbitrary kind of behavior, if for the next several weeks and months there isn't tangible evidence that the Supreme Military Council that has taken over control for the reformist movement, supervising even Omar Suleiman, if they don't begin to deliver, I think you're going to see this movement back in the streets.
Now, Aaron David Miller, a lot of people in Washington may ask, looking at Hosni Mubarak as a longtime ally of the U.S., who lost Egypt? And you take that up at foreignpolicy.com.
Well, we're great at beating ourselves up, and there will be a current, even though this so far has had a kind of Hollywood happy ending. There were those who argued we should never have supported the Mubarak regime for this long. We missed a chance over the last couple of years, this administration, to preempt exactly what happened on the streets by failing to press Mubarak for reform. And we should have, during the course of this crisis, taken a much more aggressive role in trying to push Mubarak out. And the answer to that is this is not our revolution. And the reality was we had very limited options in the last several weeks. There's no question about that. I mean, there are those who argued that we should have done more over the course of the last 2 years to press Mubarak on reform. There are those who argued during the course of the crisis we dropped the ball, we were on the wrong side of history, we should have interceded, called for Mubarak's ouster. But I think this basically misses the point, misses the fact that the bed we've made limited those options in the last several years and several weeks because we chose, essentially, to engage in a bargain with these authoritarian regimes. You protect our interests and help advance them in war-making and peacemaking, and we'll basically give you a pass on governance. That proposition is coming apart. It's come apart in Egypt. And a new contract, it seems to me, is going to have to be renegotiated. But we don't control the world, and it's just as well, frankly, that we kept our distance from this one.
And as a longtime mediator for about two decades trying to arrange peace between Israel and the Palestinians, you often met with Hosni Mubarak. Didn't you and your teams in the U.S. government know that eventually he's got to go?
The Middle East has been a very stable place for a very long time, and authoritarian, autocratic rulers in Syria, in Jordan, in Egypt, in Saudi Arabia, in Kuwait have governed, have ruled for decades. And the reality is, I think American policymakers, including myself, got used to it. We turned a blind eye to the corruption. We could no more micromanage change in Egypt. We made our judgment. We backed a regime that helped us manage our interests. And the bargain, by the way, did not produce a Middle East that was on the verge of nirvana. It helped us manage a very tricky issue. But just look around. The Middle East does not have peace. It's not a stable place. And it's not a secure place.
A scholar and author now at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., former U.S. government mediator in the Mideast, Aaron David Miller. Thank you, Aaron.
You're welcome.
I'm Dan Revive with a special edition of the CBS News Weekend Roundup, Revolution in Egypt.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Revive.
Here's an interesting fact. Of all the soda, or pop, as some people call it, that Americans drink, 31% is sugar-free. But CBS News national correspondent Jim Axelrod reports on a federally funded study revealed at the American Stroke Association conference in Los Angeles that may take away some of the flavor in your fizz.
Hannah Gardner's team studied more than 2,500 people in New York City and found those drinking diet soda had a 48% higher risk of stroke than those who reported no soda drinking.
We know that that sugar and calories are not healthy. However, this was the first study to show that there may actually be health consequences of consuming diet soda. We did not see a significant association between regular soft drink consumption and risk of combined vascular events, but we did see it for diet soda.
Americans drink 4.2 billion gallons of diet soda each year. That's nearly a third of all soda consumed in this country. Since the people studied may have had other risk factors, much more investigation must now be done. But doctors say the study does deliver a valid warning.
We can't conclude anything definitive. There needs to be more research. But I think it starts to give suggestions that maybe drinking diet soda is not the best thing for us.
That's Dr. William Borden at the Perelman Heart Institute of New York Presbyterian Weill Cornell Hospital. Again, the alleged danger of diet soda and increased risk of suffering a stroke. A new study this past week showed strokes have been reduced among older Americans, thanks in part to better medications, but the stroke risk is up among the middle-aged and the young. As young as age 15, an alarming increase in strokes. Researchers say obesity causes that. Now let's consider liquid calories and efforts by some legislators to add to the cost of high-calorie soft drinks, a lobby group that wants us to have the choice to drink full-sugar sodas has again been buying TV commercial time. Have you heard this message? It resonates with what a lot of political conservatives say.
Telling me how I should do it. They want to put new taxes on a lot of groceries I buy, like soft drinks, juice drinks, sports drinks, even flavored waters. Trying to control what we eat and drink with taxes.
Paid for, that commercial says on the screen, by Americans Against Food Taxes.
Just getting too involved.
That coalition includes grocers, McDonald's, Burger King, and the Taco Bell company Yum Brands, also PepsiCo and Coca-Cola. Now a one-woman lobby influential here in Washington, D.C., the First Lady. Michelle Obama marked the first anniversary of her campaign against childhood obesity. It's called Let's Move. Courtesy of the Today Show, let's hear what she said on NBC.
I've always talked about balance in this campaign. I mean, we're really trying to make some changes. And if you go at a parent and say, you can never take your kid to get a burger, You've lost them, because that's not the reality that we live in. It's not my reality. People are ready to make some hard changes in their lives and the way we live. We fundamentally started shifting the conversation in this country, and that's been a very good thing. Many of the changes for kids are small things, things like adding fruits and vegetables and getting our kids moving and putting more water in the diet. These are all doable things.
Michelle Obama claiming some success in schools.
We're seeing some of the most sweeping changes in school lunches that we've seen in generations.
And on her family's health? On the report, her husband, the president, has quit smoking. It's been about a year since he had a cigarette. Michelle Obama said she's proud of him. And how did he quit?
I don't know. I mean, once he made the commitment to quit, I left him alone, because it's a very personal thing. I don't think that there's one right way to do it. I just know that once a person makes the decision, they have to find the best path.
And she said her daughters, Malia and Sasha, ages 12 and 9, are not on Facebook.
I'm not a big fan of young kids having Facebook, so I you know, it's not something they need.
Michelle Obama on NBC's Today Show. In a moment, who speaks for the White House? Someone new. But first to Jeff Gilbert of our Detroit station WWJ at the Chicago Auto Show.
Dodge is bringing what they call a man wagon to this show, a macho version of the Caravan minivan. Hyundai, meanwhile, has a new sporty car. Buick's Tony DeSale showing off a hybrid version of the Regal with a system they're calling E-Assist.
It's the perfect brand for what this does. It assists the fundamental power plant.
And in a city where snow is piled up everywhere, Chrysler is showing off a new midsize convertible. Jeff Gilbert, CBS News, Chicago.
Now to the White House. We've gotten used to the voice of Robert Gibbs.
And their level of
and his little hesitations after 2 years as press secretary to the president. Gibbs is leaving. Friday was his last daily briefing. He is expected to resurface within a year as part of Barack Obama's Chicago-based reelection campaign. More from CBS News White House correspondent Peter Mayer.
His successor, Jay Carney, Vice President Biden's spokesman and a former Time magazine White House correspondent. Gibbs says he has already given some time-honored advice to Carney.
Regardless of what you know and what you're asked, your solemn obligation is to always tell the truth. And while that may seem readily obvious, obviously in the past it's not always been the case.
The daily White House briefing with live mics and cameras and a word-by-word official transcript is, in effect, a lie detector. Past press secretaries have learned that the hard way. Check the history of Watergate, Iran-Contra, and other controversies. That's not to say that press secretaries have necessarily lied on purpose. They have at times been the victims of bad information passed on by White House officials covering themselves and their boss. Some reporters have griped that Robert Gibbs has not been forthcoming enough with his answers, but for the public and journalists, better to get a bland response than a falsehood.
It is one of the most challenging jobs, I think, that is had in all of this government, for the precise reason of we're up here talking about a subject that can influence what happens 10 miles and 10,000 miles away.
There are two kinds of White House press secretaries: advisors who have total access to the president, and mouthpieces who are handed messages to read from the podium with little or no elaboration. Jay Carney can look to two predecessors who are the gold standard of White House press secretaries: Marlon Fitzwater, who served Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, and Mike McCurry, who advised and spoke for Bill Clinton in good times and the worst of times during the impeachment crisis. They knew exactly how to balance the spokesman and advisory roles. Even before Jay Carney makes his podium debut, there are promises that he will be in the loop. But as press secretaries for previous presidents have learned, those promises can fall flat, obliterated by flowcharts and West Wing turf battles. That briefing room podium will be the proving ground for the next Obama press secretary's level of influence and access. Peter Mayer, CBS News, The White House.
Please follow us on Twitter. He's at Peter Mayer CBS. For the latest headlines, at CBS Radio News. And I'm at Dan Raviv.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Raviv.
Here's a chillingly impressive nature story from CBS News correspondent Sam Litzinger.
As was once announced proudly in a newsreel from the 1950s,
the Arctic, which has kept its icy secrets for centuries, is yielding at last to the scientific assaults of man.
And one of the inhabitants of that frozen land is the polar bear. Kieran Mulvaney is author of The Great White Bear, a natural and unnatural history of the polar bear.
It's very hard to not anthropomorphize when talking about a polar bear, especially one in the wild. There's something extraordinarily impressive about it. It looks, and maybe you go into it with preconceived notions that you know that this is the top predator, but it seems to carry about it a kind of bearing, that kind of, I'm here, I'm the alpha, a swaggering, quiet confidence as it pads across the ice. I've been on icebreakers, and I've been on ships where we've stopped and looked at whales, we've stopped and looked at other wildlife, but never before have I seen an impact on a ship's crew the way that the call to come up and see a wild polar bear had on the crew of the icebreaker that I was on when we first saw polar bears in the wild. It's an extraordinary thing.
And they eat...
seals. It's all about the seals, particularly ringed seals. Ringed seals is a species that has adapted particularly well to the sea ice of the Arctic. Instead of always having to look for gaps in the ice, it has these incredible long claws on its flippers that it uses to carve holes through ice floes. And it can use those holes to pop up and breathe, and that's great for a ringed seal, but it also acts as a target for polar bears that wander around the ice, look for these holes, and just often sit and patiently wait.
What's a bear's social life? A polar bear's social life? Is it busy?
They're very interesting in the sense that they're asocial animals. They don't have social groupings, don't have family units, other than when it's a mother with cubs. But they will hang out with their peers. The big mature males tend not to hang out together. They live pretty solitary lives.
Do they live a long time up there?
They can do. It's reckoned that they can probably live up to about 20, 25 years, something like that, if everything goes well. The biggest source of mortality in the end for a lot of male bears is just the constant battles that they undergo during mating season. One of the best ways to tell that a male bear is a male bear, A, they're bigger.
How big are we talking?
They can get up to about 1,500 pounds. And also they'll often, the mature bears, mature males will have marks on their faces and they'll have bits of ears bitten off and things like that, just a consequence of mating battles over the years.
Is all going well for polar bears?
All is not going well for polar bears, particularly for polar bears in some parts of the world. At the southern parts of their range, we're already seeing, as a result of increasing temperatures, increased melt in the sea ice that they need. So they're able to spend less time out on the sea ice, and they're able to gather less food, hunt fewer seals.
What happens if we lose the polar bears?
It's yet another example of our own actions having a negative impact on the natural world. But it will also be a sign of a rapidly, rapidly changing Arctic environment, which in turn will be a sign of a rapidly changing global environment. And that could have all kinds of different consequences for humanity.
Kieran Mulvaney is author of The Great White Bear, A Natural and Unnatural History of the Polar Bear. For the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Sam Litzinger.
This past week, the referendum results from southern Sudan were announced. Keep in mind, Sudan is the country on the African map just south of Egypt. Sudan has not been stable, but with international supervision, almost 4 million people in the south have voted on breaking away from the north. More than 98% voted yes. Let's turn to a human rights lawyer who spends a lot of time in Sudan, Rebecca Hamilton. You're the author of a new book called Fighting for Darfur. Now, that part of Sudan that has suffered terribly, it's not involved in this secession vote.
That's correct. The part that is breaking away is the south of the country, whereas Darfur is in the west of the country.
So Darfur is not involved in this at all, or the central government in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, will be weakened and might think differently about its behavior on every front?
Certainly Darfur is not involved in this separation at all, but you're right that it could change the dynamics in Khartoum that could in turn have an effect on the way the conflict is resolved in Darfur.
So in this referendum, who voted? Describe southern Sudan.
It's an area that is vastly undeveloped. It has been in war for much of the time since Sudanese independence back in 1956. And the population there are primarily African. Religiously, they tend to be Christian or traditionalist in their beliefs. They're quite distinct from the people in the north who tend to be Arab. Overwhelmingly, the people in the north tend to be Muslim.
Here's a statement from President Obama after the referendum results came in. And this would be a dream, I imagine, for people in southern Sudan who wanted to have their own country. I am therefore pleased to announce the intention of the United States to formally recognize southern Sudan as a sovereign independent state in July of this year. It's a dream getting recognition from the U.S.
You're right. And this new nation is going to be facing some enormous governance challenges. 85% of the population is illiterate. There are only 40 miles of paved roads in the entirety of this new nation. So it's going to require sustained international support. The U.S. has spent a lot of its leverage that it has over Khartoum to ensure that this southern referendum goes peacefully. How much leverage does it really have left to push Khartoum to stop the aerial bombardments that it is still doing in Darfur, to free up the area of Darfur so that it's open to foreign correspondence in a way that it isn't at the moment?
That's the author of a new book called Fighting for Darfur, Rebecca Hamilton. Thanks so much for explaining Sudan.
My pleasure.
And now our Weekend Roundup commentator, Charles Grodin.
I was speaking to an old friend of mine recently. I hadn't spoken to him in some time. He said he missed seeing me at a mutual friend's Christmas party. I said I was no longer in touch with that person because of her reprehensible behavior towards so many people. When I began to explain what it was clear he was uncomfortable and didn't want to hear it. I believe he made a mistake in not listening. As Aaron Sorkin once wrote, some people can't handle the truth. I'm Charles Grodin for the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Thanks for listening, and anytime you want to hear the latest news, go to cbsradionewscast.com. And if you want to find our podcasts, do an internet search for CBS Weekend Roundup. I'm Dan Raviv.
You've been listening to the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The program is produced in the Washington Bureau of CBS News. The executive producer is Howard Arenstein.